let my people go. This is, of course, one of the better known expressions in the Old Testament. It is an expression that we studied last week, if you were here. We also last week showed how this expression pointed forward to the New Testament. In speaking about the Hebrews and their being in Egyptian bondage, God said it's time for them to be let go. It's time for them to be freed from physical slavery. That pointed forward thousands of years to Christ, the New Testament, where people would be freed by Christ, freed from the problem of sin. Whether you were in the assembly last Sunday night or not and heard that material, tonight I want to build on what we studied last week. God wanted his people to be released, let my people go. We looked at this expression several times from the book of Exodus. And then we looked at the second point. God said, you let my people go so they can serve me. And we find this information in places like Exodus 7, verse 16. What was that service going to involve? Why did God say, let my people go that they may serve me? Well, part of that service was going to involve worship. And tonight, this is the subject that we want to consider. What does the Bible tell us about worship? When we think about worship, how important is it? Is all the worship that is directed to God accepted by God? We can ask a lot of questions about worship, and these questions are answered in both the New Testament as well as the Old Testament. One of the first things, and if you've already turned to Deuteronomy 7, we're going to be reading verses 2 through 6 in just a moment. One of the first things that we see about worship, especially when we look at the Old Testament, is that it can be contrary to God's will. When worship is contrary to God's will, as we'll see tonight, it is simply unacceptable. Now, Deuteronomy 7, which we're about to read from, we read about some people. And these people are people who worshipped. From what's said, it seems like these people were very devout. They were very committed to their worship. We're going to see from Deuteronomy 7 that they had altars. They spent some time, some resources, some money to construct altars. They had images. They also had pillars associated with their worship. Deuteronomy 7, starting with verse 2. And when Jehovah thy God shall deliver them up before thee, and thou shalt smite them. God said, I want you to utterly destroy them. Then shalt thou utterly destroy them, thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son. Why? Verse 4 says, for he will turn away thy son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of Jehovah be kindled against you, and he will destroy thee quickly. But, verse 5, thus shall ye deal with them. Ye shall break down their altars. You need to dash in pieces their pillars and hew down their asherim and burn their graven images with fire. And then verse 6. For thou art a holy people unto Jehovah thy God. Jehovah thy God hath chosen thee to be a people for his own possession above all peoples that are upon the face of the earth. God made it clear to his people that they were going to encounter some individuals who were worshipers. God said, you're going to come into this land and you're going to find some people who are very, very religious. When you find these people, though, God said, I do not want you to become involved with them. You certainly do not participate in the worship that they have chosen to involve themselves in. Now, this is interesting because in our day and time, we live in a culture where a lot of people say, well, you have your religion, you have your church, and I have my religion, I have my church, and we should all get along. That's not how God saw things under the Old Testament era. It was not, we're all in this together. God said, when you come into the area and you see this religion that is not authorized by me, when you come in and you see this false religion, God said, you go in there and you tear it down. God said, you go in there and you destroy it. God also said something else. God said, when you get to this area, you do not make a covenant. You do not make an agreement with these people who are involved with false worship, verse 2. And then in verse 3, he said, in addition to not making any covenants, any agreements, God also said that you are not allowed to have your children marry these folks. No marriages. Your sons, your daughters, they can't be involved with these people who are involved with false religion. God said, if this were to occur, my people are going to be turned away from me. And that's simply unacceptable. In God's eyes, there was a huge, huge difference between true religion and false religion. The erroneous religion in this chapter, verse 5, it had to be destroyed. God said, you've got to wipe it out. Throughout the Old Testament, we find a number of verses which talk about false, improper religion. Even a casual reading of the prophets shows that this topic is one that was dealt with time and time again. Well, as we leave the Old Testament and we turn to the New, guess what? God's Word continues to give instructions about worship and information about worship as we look at the life of Christ and really throughout the entire New Testament. In fact, if we look at the life of Jesus, one of the very first things that's discussed is the subject of worship. Think about Matthew 2:2, the wise men. They'd come from a distant place. Why? They said, we are here to worship the Lord. And if worship can be done in any old way, if it really doesn't matter, why do these men travel so far? Why do they spend the time and the money, maybe about a year of their lives, to worship if it doesn't matter? Two chapters later, Matthew chapter 4, verse 9, we once again have the subject of worship being introduced. But on this occasion, we have the devil talking about worship. In one of the recorded temptations, Satan said to Jesus, worship me, fall down and worship me, and I'm going to give you all these things. Jesus' temptations tell us that Satan understands the importance of worship. People today don't always understand the importance of it, but the devil does. Satan also understands the power of false worship. We're not going to look at it, but in the 1 Corinthians letter, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 20, Paul makes a clear connection between false worship and demons, or Satan. He says, essentially in 1 Corinthians 10, 20, that false worship is a front for Satan and some of his activities. False worship is one of Satan's key tools in his spiritual offensive against mankind. Certainly in our day and time, the devil continues to use false worship to deceive people. When we hear things like, there are many ways to serve God, many ways to worship God, you have your way, I have my way, the folks over here, they have their way as well, that's not a message from God. That's never been God's view about worship. That message is a message from the devil. After Satan tried to entice Jesus with false worship, the Lord rebuked him. Matthew chapter 4, verse 10, Jesus went back to the Old Testament and he said, only God deserves worship. Can't give it to you, Satan. You're not deity. You don't deserve it. The Lord knew that proper or true worship has only one right object, and that's the God of heaven and earth. This is one of the problems that was true for the false worship in the Old Testament. It was directed towards the wrong object, the Asherim, not deity, but a God that had been constructed in the minds of men. So Satan has corrupted a number of minds when it comes to the subject of worship. Even now, we find that the devil deceives people when it comes to worship. Throughout our world, we have places where folks still offer homage to rocks and trees and animals and even people. In the first century, Colossians 2, verse 18, tells us that there were people who worshipped angels. We might not think that that makes much sense today, but there were actually people who did this kind of thing. So Jesus, Matthew 4, verse 9 and following says, worship has to have the right object, and that has to be God. And then a little later, John 4, verse 24. In the life of Christ, as it steadily progressed, we see Jesus talking about worship once again. He's already talked about in Matthew 4, the right object. But then in John 4, he talks about doing worship or engaging in worship in the right way. In that conversation with a Samaritan woman, Jesus said, when you worship, it must be. It has to be according to truth. That word must means that there is no other way to worship if we want God to accept it. And that truth, of course, Jesus defined it later, John 17, 17, worshiping in truth means worshiping according to the Word of God. When we look to the New Testament, we have a lot of information and insight on the actions or activities associated with worship. In fact, we find five different acts. We find information about praying. When it comes to worship, we also find information about singing. There's information about teaching or preaching, the Lord's Supper, and then, of course, there's also information about giving. The Bible, in addition to specifying the various acts of worship, also has some information on the right attitudes. It's important, it's necessary to have the right actions, but it's also necessary to have the right attitudes. And this is one of the things that was a problem at Corinth. The Corinthians, they had the Lord's Supper. They were involved with teaching because of the spiritual gifts. They certainly were involved with giving. 1 Corinthians chapter 16 seems that they were doing fairly well in the area of praying, but they did not do well in the area of attitude. We know from 1 Corinthians 11 that they had some bad attitudes when it came time for the Lord's Supper. 1 Corinthians 13 is all about love. They had some bad attitudes when it came to the subject of love. In addition to acts, in addition to attitudes, worship, God even breaks it down to the point of gender. God, when he gives insight about worship in the New Testament, says that it is something that is to be conducted by males, men. In 1 Timothy 2, verse 8, it seems Paul is presenting a public situation, a public assembly, if you will. And when he talks about prayer, he uses a word that is specifically associated with the male gender. Worship is something that is common to most people. God knows that. It's been true in the Old Testament era. It's true under the New Testament era. The Bible thus recognizes this natural human desire or tendency, and the Scripture regulates it in both the Old Testament and the New. Now, in our modern society, people think that they oftentimes have come up with some better ideas. And worship is one of the areas where people think that they've come to some new insights. We hear from time to time people who say, well, we have now progressed. We are such an enlightened society that worship is no longer necessary. Those ignorant people from the past, oh, they needed it. It was probably helpful to them, but now we are so advanced that man has outgrown his need for worship. One of the interesting things about worship is that God has never put a date on it. If we buy some milk, if we buy some cheese or bread, there's usually an expiration date stamped on the product. Use this by. Medicine also has an expiration date. But when it comes to worship, the biblical picture is that it is something that involves man, not only in this life, but really throughout eternity. There is no termination point for it. Consider how early we read about worship in the Bible. We have information about it in Genesis chapter 4. Cain and Abel, what were they doing? They were bringing their offering to God. They were offering worship. Genesis 22 verse 5, there was that man by the name of Abraham. What did he do? He said to some servants, you stay here. The lad and I, we're going to go off yonder and we're going to worship. So throughout the book of Genesis, early in the history of mankind, we have some information about worship. As we see those various aspects of worship throughout time, we then move forward thousands of years to the book of Revelation. And what do we find in Revelation 4 verse 10? John here gives us a picture, not of earth, but he gives us a picture of what's going, what heaven is going to be like. It's a very brief picture. And in Revelation 4 verse 10, he talks about worshiping God. So worship is something that God intended not only to span throughout time, but worship is also something that is going to be part of eternity. It does not have a termination point. Now men can say that worship is no longer necessary. We've become so enlightened, we don't need it anymore, but God has commanded worship. We cited earlier Matthew 4. In Matthew 4 verse 10, Jesus there gives some information about worship. He says, worship God. Not worship God for, you know, the next 6 months or the next year or the next century, but worship God. This is something that is to be an ongoing activity. Luke's point, comment about this, Luke 4 verse 8 is very similar. He says, it is written. What's written? Worship God. This is one of the things that is designed to be a natural part of life. So regardless of what society says, regardless of what people in society think about worship, it is a command of God. So as long as this earth stands and throughout eternity, the people who want to do what is right, they will be involved with worship. Now the command of worship is like God's other commands. When God gives a command, there's always a reason for it. There is a logical basis for the things that God has told people to do. Well, when we worship, we find that with that worship, we are acknowledging, we are saying that God is the one who is the Lord of our life. God is the one who's in control. And our worship calls us to recognize that. And with this call, there is a reminder that we need to be obedient to His will. God's will, of course, is expressed in the Scriptures. It's that truth that we talked about in John 17, verse 17. And when we think about worship, this submission to God, worship is a reminder that God has given us information through the Scriptures, and we're bound to follow that information. Worship is, in some respects, really a call not only to honor God, but it is a call to keep people on the right road. This fact is illustrated pretty well by the Old Testament. When we think about passages such as we started with, Deuteronomy chapter 7, when folks worshiped incorrectly, what happened? Were they on the right road or were they on the wrong road? Well, when we look at Deuteronomy 7, we find that they were not on the right road. False worship ultimately caused people to turn to wicked and heathen practices. When we go back to the Old Testament and we look at the false worship that was practiced, we find some of the consequences. There were people who, because of the false worship, they became involved with sexual sin. They became involved with child abuse. They became involved with drunkenness and all kinds of other things that were not very good things. When people get away from true worship, generally these negative consequences still follow today. So man needs worship for the best possible life. But that worship, it has to be the right worship. It has to be the proper or the approved worship. When we have that right or that approved worship taking place in our life, we get some benefits. One of those benefits, of course, is fellowship. Stated another way, when we worship God in the right way, we have a relationship with God. I find it interesting that people, as they go through life, oftentimes worship is the last thing that's on their mind. But when they go through life and they have a big issue, when there is a serious loss, when there is a serious health problem, or they're going through some other catastrophe, then they call out to God. God, we want you. God, we want your aid. Urgent pleas are made for deity to intervene. Over the years, I've taken hundreds, probably well over 1,000 benevolence calls. Usually when a person calls and they begin their sales pitch, if you will, they want money for rent and different things, I'll ask some standard questions. One of those questions is typically, do you have any religious affiliation? In almost every case that I can think of, people will say, oh, I'm a Christian. I read the Bible. I'm saved. Well, once they tell me those things, I ask, where do you worship? Invariably, the question is, well, I don't worship anywhere. Well, how can that be? Or they would say, well, I worship at this particular place. And I say, well, let's check with them. And I don't have any money down there. Well, that's okay. Let me talk to the preacher. And in more cases than not, people will say at that particular religious group, well, they visited once last week, or they've been here two or three times. People will call on God for aid, or they'll make references to their relationship with Him. But they don't have that relationship. They're not honoring Him. They're not serving Him. There is no fellowship there. In Hebrews 10, and we're going to read from this passage a little bit later, but in Hebrews 10, verse 22, it says, let us draw near to God. Why? Because if we're going to have a relationship with God, we've got to be in fellowship with Him. And part of that fellowship, part of that relationship, is going to occur through or by worship. Now, how do I know that? I know that because Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, that God's people, Christians, males and females, were a royal priesthood. Now, think about priests. They've been assigned to a religious function, and they never worship. They're just kind of off here somewhere. And maybe they show up, you know, once a year, once every 10 years. That makes no sense whatsoever. If you are a royal priest, part of the royal priesthood, well, we're going to be involved with things like worship. And that's what Peter says about God's people. We're part of that royal priesthood. That puts us in a point where places an obligation on us to be regular in worship. We are, Paul said in Colossians 1, verse 12, to give thanks unto God the Father because we have this spiritual inheritance. When are we going to do that? Well, one of the times is going to be worship. The walking in the light, 1 John 1, verse 7, that doesn't exclusively mean worship, but certainly worship would be involved with this as well. So when the world comes along and says, well, society has moved beyond worship. This was something for the people in the past. God says, no, that's not right. That kind of idea is very, very wrong. Worship is necessary because it reminds us of our obligations and it helps us maintain a good relationship with God. Now, what I'm about to say may to some seem like it's harsh or critical, and I certainly do not want to come across that way or give that impression, but some might, I guess, take it in this particular way. And what I'm about to say has some exceptions. But what I want to observe from Hebrews 10, I'm willing to contend it is generally true. That is, in more cases than not, this information is accurate. The Bible makes, at least in most cases, a connection between a person's commitment to God, and this would include worship, and their usefulness to God. I base this on Hebrews 10, verses 24 and 25. Now, a little bit ago, I cited Hebrews 10, let us draw near. Let's get close to God. And now, I want to see what comes after this particular passage. Now, as we turn to Hebrews 10, 24 and 25, it's helpful, I think, to remember what's involved with this letter. The general context of the Hebrew letter involves people who are going through some difficult times. These people have come out of a background associated with Judaism, the Old Testament law. And now with hard times, living the Christian life, they're facing things like persecution. And as they look at their life, they're thinking, well, hey, this is a pretty difficult road. And things were not nearly as difficult for us when we were following that Old Testament system that involved Moses and the animal sacrifices. So if it was easier with that Old Testament system, and we're having lots of problems trying to move forward with the New Testament system, maybe it's better to go back to the Old Testament system. Let's forsake Christ, let's turn from Christianity, and let's go back and let's serve God with the Old Testament system. So this is why the Hebrew writer throughout the book says there is a better system, there is a superior system. Stick with Christ, forget Moses, forget the Old Testament sacrifices. These things have been put away. Hebrews 10, verses 24 and 25. And let us consider one another to provoke unto love and good works, not forsaking our own assembling together as the custom of some is, but we need to exhort one another, and so much the more as you see the day drawing nigh. The word provoke in verse 24 is an important word. This word has the sense of stimulate. Sometimes we say a person needs to be stimulated. They need to be shocked. They need to be woken up. Now imagine a person who is mentally stimulated twice a year. When Christmas time comes, they're mentally stimulated. when Easter time comes, they're mentally stimulated. And that is the only mental stimulation that they get in their life. What kind of brain are they going to have? Well, not much is going to be going on upstairs if they're only getting mental stimulation once or twice a year, or maybe, you know, once every 3 or 4 years. Well, let's switch from the brain to the physical body. Let's suppose that we have an individual, and this individual physically is stimulated only once or twice a year. What kind of body is he going to have? Well, the muscles are going to go into atrophy. The kind of person is not going to be able to walk. He's not going to be able to function. Everything is basically going to shut down in the spiritual body. That kind of person would be very, very unhealthy. Well, this is what was happening to these folks. They were drifting. They were headed back to that Old Testament system. So the Hebrew writer says, you need to stimulate one another. You need to go ahead and shock one another. You need to go ahead and wake one another up. You need to provoke one another. Get one another on board. Activate one another. Christian assemblies, and this is, of course, a place where we come together to worship. Our assemblies are designed in part to stimulate us, to encourage us to live the Christian life. So if we are not receiving stimulation on a regular basis, if we're not being provoked on a regular basis, our usefulness to God's probably not going to be very strong, because we're not being stimulated or provoked, and our faith is going to suffer and very likely die. Then in verse 25, which was also read, the Hebrew writer uses another key word. He says, exhorting one another. These assemblies, he said, that you're forsaking, they're designed to help keep you on track. You're not only worshiping God, you're serving Him in truth, but it is a place where you can come and you can receive exhortation. Or to put it in more modern terms, we might say that you're receiving at least a little boost of spiritual energy. I've been to some assemblies over the years, and I think that this is probably true for most of us, where we go through a worship period. Maybe we've gone through the Bible classes for the day, and after all was said and done, there was nothing at the end of the day that was really new to us. All the songs, all the hymns that we sung, we've sung them before. We've thought about the words at various times, so really it was no new hymns. And the prayers, well, really there was nothing new that was offered as far as information in the prayers. And when God's people came together and they surrounded the Lord's table and we went through the various aspects of that part of our worship, well, we've heard those passages read before, and the comments that were made, that information was not new to us. And the Bible classes that were taught, maybe that was familiar information. And maybe the sermons that were preached that day, we could have preached them better than the preacher preached them. All that information was new to us. Maybe we taught some of the same information. But still, by our coming together, by that worship, we were stimulated. We were exhorted. We were given some spiritual strength. But the people who were thinking about, hey, let's forsake Christ and let's go back there to the Old Testament system, they were not getting that stimulation. They were not getting that exhortation. And that was dragging them down even further. The world can say what it wants about worship. And there are a lot of people in our society who think that worship is something that was good for people in the past, but it is no longer relevant. It no longer has much application in our life. That is not God's view of worship. So we have to make a choice. Are we going to accept what the world says about worship, or are we going to accept what God says about worship? The service that comes through worship is a part, it is a necessary part of life. And that means that when the doors are open, that's a place where we need to come. We, as we looked at this morning from Romans 16, verse 1, Phoebe was a servant of the church. And we have that same duty, that same obligation in our lives. We want to serve God. Worship is part of that, but it's certainly by no means the only aspect or way that we serve God. There are many ways that we serve Him. So as we think about worship, we know that it can be false. Deuteronomy chapter 7. We know that it's something that's going to continue not only through this life, as long as the world stands, but it's something that's going to continue throughout eternity. It's that thing that draws us closer to God as far as fellowship. It's designed to give us that spiritual boost. And here we have a devotional. We have a small worship period on Wednesday nights. Those things are designed to help keep us strong. So like the folks in the Hebrew letter, we don't fall back. This evening, because you're here, especially because you're here tonight where the weather doesn't look like it's going to be that great, you're to be commended. And that's the kind of commitment that we want. That's the kind of commitment that we want to encourage from people as they go through life. So for the people that we can influence and encourage, worship God needs to be our message. Worship Him in truth, and worship Him as someone who's truly committed to Him. Tonight, if we can strengthen you in your commitment to God, we'd like to do that. If you are someone who has made that commitment, and tonight it certainly seems to be the case because you're here, Think about the commitment that you've made and commit to yourself that for all your days, this is going to be the way that you live your life because it is a command of God. This evening, if we can help you write your relationship with God, if we can strengthen your faith in some way, will you let us know about your need as we stand and sing the selected song?